Hello and welcome to Giving Ventures, a podcast to help you grow your giving and change the world for the better. Each episode, we share innovative charitable efforts leveraging private philanthropy to solve public problems. I'm your host, Peter Lipset, Vice President at Donors Trust. This show is a product of Donors Trust, the oldest and largest donor advised fund focused on helping conservative and libertarian donors of all capacities simplify, protect, and grow their giving. My colleagues and I talk with a lot of groups doing great work. This show lets us share a bit of what we learned with you so you can discover new projects for your own philanthropy. I'm excited to bring you something very special today. It is the audio of a webinar we at Donors Trust recently hosted on the issue of donor intent. Donor intent is a big deal for us at Donors Trust. We were founded with the mission to preserve and protect the intent for liberty-minded donors. Yeah, I'm sure you've heard the stories, the sad stories of foundations like Pew and Ford and Rockefeller and all these others that no longer support the free market values that were the values of their wealth creator. As we often say, though, you don't have to be a billionaire to have your intent go adrift after you're gone. If you don't have a plan for protecting your charitable legacy, then you create an opening for someone else to create that plan for you. The conversation you're going to hear explores how you can better protect your charitable intentions. First, we hear from Bill Simon. I interview him. Bill is a name that might be familiar to you from his business or political past, but he is here in the capacity as chairman of the William E. Simon Foundation. He shares some terrific knowledge about his experience working with his dad and with his siblings to craft the foundation's intent, including setting a date for the foundation to close its doors. After that, you're going to hear from my colleague Lucas Dwelly as he interviews Bob Rubin, who's a terrific wealth advisor from Florida, working specifically with conservative clients, and they discuss how you can protect your intent even while taking care of those that you love. And then wrapping it all up, Donors Trust President and CEO will give some practical advice on how to apply these lessons about donor intent to your own charitable giving. And throughout moderating the discussion, you'll hear my colleague Stephanie Lips. And then I'll pop back on at the end and give some closing thoughts. So let's jump in.
Hi, clients and DT friends. I am Stephanie Lips, and I've been blessed to have been at Donors Trust for the past 5 years. Welcome. Donor intent has been a core component of DT from its founding in 1999. The threat of mission drift is high for donors committed to the principles of liberty. We have all heard horror stories from organizations such as the Ford Foundation. I'm sure Henry Ford is rolling in his grave right now, as the fortune he created through free enterprise is now used to attack free enterprise. Just this past month, we've been hearing from those who have been making large contributions to their alma mater. These universities did not anything on their campuses to tamp down the recent anti-Semitism, reminiscent of Europe in 1939. It doesn't have to be this way. On today's call, we will explore practical ways you define and secure your intentions and leave the legacy that you want to leave. Today, we'll hear from Bill Simon on how his family came together to protect his father's legacy and why they're going to shut down their foundation at the end of this year. Then investment advisor Bill Rubin, someone I am lucky to call a friend, will share ways to plan out your legacy to take care of your loved ones and the causes you care about. Finally, Donors Trust President and CEO Lawson Bader will bring it all together with concrete steps you can take to create a lasting charitable legacy. We'll leave time at the end for your questions. You're welcome to add them in the Q&A box in Zoom at any time. First, I'll hand it off to my colleague, Peter Lipset, VP here at Donors Trust, to talk with Bill Simon.
Thank you, Stephanie, so much. Thank you, everybody, for joining us today. We are very excited to have this conversation with you and hope you'll have some great questions at the end. I am thrilled to be talking to Bill Simon. Bill Simon is a name familiar to many of you, a great entrepreneur, recovering politician, but most importantly for our purposes here today, co-chairman of the William E. Simon Foundation, a great important conservative foundation that has done phenomenal work over the past several decades and will close its doors at the end of the year, which is a phenomenal thing in and of itself. Bill, welcome.
Thank you, Peter.
So let's begin with the end, as it were. Naomi Schaefer Riley had a great piece in the Wall Street Journal back in August talking about this idea of sunsetting, the foundations closing their doors after some period of time, and led talking about the William E. Simon Foundation, how you'll be closing your doors at the end of the year after having given away more than $300 million in the past several decades. So why sunset the foundation? Talk to us about that.
Well, you know, Dad was a man that expressed his opinions very clearly. And he was a leader in so many ways and a great example for his children, of which I'm one of seven. And so in terms of his intent, he made it very clear to us over a substantial period of time exactly how he wanted his foundation to operate after he died. And in addition, we started meeting about 2 years before Dad died in 2000. So in 1998, we met four times, and 1999, four times. So actually two times. So we had the benefit of seeing Dad in action for a number of meetings, and that was very helpful. So although he didn't actually put down in writing what his intent was, he had numerous conversations with his seven children, and also, you know, with three trusted advisors who were on the board. Jim Pearson, who many of you know, was an extraordinary counselor to us, in addition to being president of the foundation during the entire time and a board member. And Dan Mosley, a partner, former partner at Cravath, who had been Dad's lawyer, and Bill Wachenfeld, who was a high school friend of Dad. So, you know, it was pretty clear. There were some issues, there were some questions that were left open, but we can maybe address that later.
And so why the decision to close the doors? And we want to talk, I want to dive deeper into what the intent was, but why close the doors?
Sure. Very simply, it's a little bit related to what Stephanie said in her introduction about how sometimes there's drift, you might call it, and after the donor passes away, and there's a group of trustees that take matters into their own hands. And Dad had seen what had happened at the Ford Foundation that Stephanie referenced, and there's a number of other foundations where similar things happen. I remember one conversation that my brother Pete and I had with Dad about sunsetting, and he specifically said, you know, I love all my grandchildren. There were 26 of them at that point. And he said, but I don't know them. They're all very young. They were all under the age of 10. He said, however, I know my seven children well, and I have tried explicitly and implicitly through my example to let you know exactly, you know, what my intent is and will be. And so I have no doubt whatsoever that the seven of you, combined with my three dear friends I just mentioned a moment ago, will do, in Dad's term, and Dad loved to use the word terrific. And so he would say, I know you will do a terrific job. And then sometimes he would joke and he'd say, and if you don't, well, you know, I'm going to try to figure out a way to come back in some form or other.
You mentioned your dad had never really written it down, but you and your siblings came together, pulled this out of him. Talk to us about that process. And also, what was the intent? What did you really define as being the goals of this big foundation?
Well, Peter, again, not to clarify your question, but you never had to pull anything out of Dad. And we had a lot of conversations about it. You know, we talked about it during those official board meetings, of course. None of us really knew when Dad was going to pass away, of course, in June of 2000. It was actually 2 weeks after a board meeting. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't really a question mark. The question was more allocation. So we knew that Dad later in his life had begun to focus more and more on, I might call it, person-to-person contact, initiatives that related to family, faith, and education. You know, he'd been a huge public figure, had been, you know, active in expressing his opinions on a variety of public policy issues. So we knew that he would have loved to focus a little bit on the policy. And of course, when you have a world-class expert like Jim Pearson, it would have been a shame not to focus a little bit on policy. But mostly we focused on, you know, helping people help themselves, consistent with Dad's idea that personal responsibility was a, let's say, it was a pillar of his own personal philosophy.
Yeah, well, that's a critical core. It's one we share here at Donors Trust as well. Now, so you and your siblings, you come together as your dad passes away, you're running the foundation. That was, am I getting the timeline right? Early 90s, right? When or no, you said he passed away in 2000. So, you know, here we are 23 years later, times change. Talk to us both about how as a family you've actually been able to work together to steward that intent. And also, as times change, I mean, education is a big issue for you. That is hugely different from where it was in 2000. So how do you moderate the intent as things change in the public sphere?
Well, that's a great question, Peter. And you're right that times change. And, you know, so it really required all of us to work together, meaning the seven siblings, but also with the wise counsel of our three non-family trustees. And I don't know, God must be looking out for us, Peter, but it was a pretty smooth path. I mean, sometimes we didn't agree, but it never got to the point where there were any heated words. It was more, I'd say, opinions, occasionally strong opinions that were expressed. But, you know, so take, for example, education. The times had changed, as you point out, and, you know, the school choice movement was in its infancy when Dad passed away on June 3rd, 2000. And, you know, through relationships that we had, both through college and, you know, other projects that we'd engaged with, you know, we had met, for example, a great individual named Bill Obendorf, who had started AFC. And Pete went on the board of it, my brother Pete. You know, we saw a lot of Bill, still do, actually. And that is something that we are firmly of the belief that Dad would have supported that with, you know, with both feet.
And so as we wrap up here, what advice would you give to those on the call, some of whom have great donor intent plans in place, but maybe you're making sure it's up to snuff, some who may not have really gone through this process before, as they define their legacy? And you know, maybe if there's any color of your own thoughts on this, particularly related to you, as you close a foundation, close one chapter and move on to a new chapter of your philanthropy.
Well, I, you know, once again, that's a very important question. Could be the most, well, outside of donor intent, could be the most important question. I would just encourage donors to begin working actively with, whether it's their family who will be on the board or whether it's their outside advisors and good friends that will be on the board. But it's not too soon to start. As I said, in 1998, we started meeting as a family with our outside advisors. And, you know, we didn't know that we had basically six meetings. So I would say that. And, you know, you have to make an assessment on how you think everybody will get along. But I wouldn't spend a lot of time on it. You know, Dad didn't, he used to talk about analysis paralysis. I think one of the beautiful things, in addition to the millions of people that we've impacted over these 23 years, is the fact that it's brought the seven of us closer. We were pretty close before, for sure. But when you're meeting a couple of times a year, you're getting to know somebody in a totally different context. You know, we were busy with our lives at that point with young kids. Now we have grandkids. And so it provided a great opportunity for all of us to work together. And it was one of the two, I'd say, the donor intent and, you know, the legacy that mom and dad are able to leave behind, that we were able to follow their wishes, but also the fact that we all got to work together. So I would say, just if there was one bit of advice, I say it's not too early to start. Not too early to start.
That's great. And as you say, the legacy is more than the money. Bringing the family together, that matters too. That's great. But now I'm going to hand the reins over to Lucas Dwelly, my colleague here. He's a philanthropic advisor with Donors Trust, focused mostly on investment advisors, wealth attorneys, et cetera, other professionals who are very good at bringing good people to the table to talk about these ideas. Lucas, take it away.
Hey, good afternoon, everyone. Live from Louisville, Kentucky. We'd like to welcome our friend, Bob Rubin. Bob is a friend not only to Donors Trust, but the conservative movement as a whole. As a financial advisor, Bob possesses a unique perspective of how he works with clients, not only to help them gain financial freedom, but philanthropic impact. Bob, thanks for being with us today, sir.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Absolutely. So a little bit of a softball question here to get us rolling. But as a financial advisor, how do you work with your clients on donor intent? You know, for us at Donor Trust, it's the foundation of how we operate as a donor advice fund. How do you work with donor intent, and do you revisit it down the road with your clients?
Well, that's a good question. And I guess when it comes to approaching donor intent with our clients at Rubin Wealth Advisors, we do take a pretty meticulous approach. Understanding our clients' values and their philanthropic goals is an integral part of our initial planning process. During our discovery phase, we really make it a point to engage in meaningful conversations about their charitable intention. I think by doing so, we gain insight into what causes that matter most to them and what legacy they wish to leave behind. I guess revisiting, you asked about revisiting, I guess, but we don't stop there, because I guess revisiting that conversation is a key practice for us. I mean, like Bill talked about, life evolves, and so do our clients' priorities and passions. What was not important to them before is I guess important to them now. So, I mean, we believe it's critical to maintain an open and ongoing dialogue with our clients to ensure that their philanthropic endeavors remain aligned with their values.
That's a great answer. So it kind of goes right into the second question here, Bob, is given how philanthropy can benefit your clients from not only a tax perspective, but also a community impact, how do you approach this conversation with your clients? And I ask this from two stages. One is as a financial advisor who may be new to the realm, that wants to broach the conversation with the client, and clients themselves who may be on the other side of that, who want to be able to broach the conversation with their FAs.
Well, I guess, you know, we know philanthropy is a powerful tool for the benefits and the community impacts, and we'll start there, right? You know, what are they trying to get done? Where do they want to go? Where do they want to put their money, and what's important to them? We encourage our clients to approach these conversations with their families and advisors openly. So it's not just between us and the client. It's between the client and their families, their advisors, because it is a family affair. It's generally not just one person saying, oh, I want to give all this money and that's it. I mean, there's other members of the family should have an impact in that. So you really want to start by discussing the causes that resonate with them and their loved ones. We try to engage in those conversations and to see how it can affect the community in which we all live.
Great answer. And I think that allows us to start talking about an area that we could spend an hour on. But in a few minutes, Bob, can we talk through some of the tools that individuals can use to help create transformational giving across the stage, whether it's in their local community or across the country?
Wow, that's a hard one to whittle down the list. There are a lot of tools, right? You know, there's the strategies such as charitable remainder trusts, CRTs, life insurance with charitable beneficiaries, family foundations, charitable lead trusts, qualified, you know, personal residence trusts, like QPERTs, charitable gifts of appreciated assets, endowed funds, and of course, donor advised funds, one of my favorite. But they all have their advantages and their disadvantages. And as we all know, what the client should use depends on their specific fact pattern.
And is that part of the discovery process, Bob, or is that just as it goes over time? Because, again, I think that would be something that would evolve through the relationship as well as your time with the clients.
Right. I think sometimes what happens is when you first start talking to a client and you're in the discovery phase and they might have charitable intent, but they really don't know how to go about doing it. You're not going to get started with the most sophisticated strategy. You're going to get started with something basic, right? So yeah, it does evolve. It goes from maybe basic to maybe more sophisticated as they move down the road. And as they get older, as they have kids and they have grandkids, the kids might go to universities and now they want to give money to universities. I would try to advise against that, like we talked about that before we got started, but or whatever that might be, it might be as they get older. I know in my community, the local hospital here is a nonprofit hospital and people give a lot of money to that hospital to get on the private floor. So whatever drives them to give the money.
Great. And Bob, finally, as a seasoned financial advisor, having weathered all sorts of economic downturns, presidential administrations, other factors like tax changes, all those things that kind of go into the thought pattern of individuals who are working with financial advisors. What do you see as the biggest advantage of working with someone like yourself, your team, kind of a quick commercial for what you do, but also just the greater philanthropic and financial advising realm?
Well, that's a great question. And I think part of your question has a little bit of the answer there too, right? Because, you know, we navigate an ever-changing financial landscape. I mean, we've weathered, like you said, economic downturns, tax changes, gaining invaluable insights along the way. And I think our clients benefit from our ability to adapt and develop strategies that safeguard their well-beings because of the experience that we bring to the table. So when we work with like development officers, DOs, estate planning attorneys, CPAs, whatever, they might have, say, a limited knowledge of the financial tools that we have available. So my advice to collaborate with seasoned financial advisors who they can help provide sort of that tailored advice to whatever the organization needs happens to be. I think what makes us a little bit different here at Rubin Wealth Advisors is that we stand as a safe haven for those who share our conservative values, and that's politically conservative values, and are generally concerned about the direction in which our country is headed. And we're here to protect their wealth, preserve their legacy, and support the causes that they hold dear in these extremely challenging times.
That's a great answer. Thank you for summing that up, Bob. And appreciate you being here today. You'll be around for some question and answer here in a few minutes. And I'd like to turn this over to Donors Trust CEO, Lawson Bader, to talk a little bit about philanthropic giving.
Thank you, Lucas. Thank you, Bill, and thank you, Bob, as well. And thank you all for being part of this. You know, Bill spoke about the value of intent. Bob spoke about some of the vehicles that are available to protect that intent. I do think it's important just to remind folks how significant the idea of donor intent is and how it has gone awry. And Stephanie alluded to America's great foundations of the 20th century, the Pew, the MacArthur, the Ford, the Rockefeller, the Carnegie. Organizations that began exclusively or entirely due to free enterprise principles, in which the purpose of the mission was to preserve those, or at least the wealth creation that generated those foundations came from those principles. It's important to mention, however, that Mr. Ford and Mr. Carnegie actually didn't write down that many instructions of what to do. So to a certain extent, while it's unfortunate, it should not be necessarily a surprise that those foundations drifted over time. We've heard a lot of conversations about universities and donor intent, and a lot of your universities are in the news right now for various reasons. There have also been some good stories where we've seen donor intent sort of taken back by donors. Princeton University and the Robertson Foundation in the early 2000s were involved in lawsuits, in which case there was a settlement, but Princeton did actually have to sort of confess to some things, return some money or redirect it in a certain way. And the same thing happened actually in a more left-leaning way with Jane Fonda and Harvard, interestingly enough, where Harvard actually had to return some money or redirect it. We've had good examples of the Daniels Foundation, for example, the Hilton Foundation, foundations that began to drift. Either staff got too involved in making decisions, and you had, in the case of the Daniels Fund, the board take back that fund, fire people, redirect. The Hilton Foundation wound up changing its entire bylaws to require the intent of Conrad Hilton be maintained. But it's also important in the larger conversation of donor intent, this is not necessarily something that is political, nor even nefarious. It can be as simple as the fact that you care about literacy issues, but maybe your children care about animal welfare or building a vibrant arts and music scene in your community. You like dogs, others like cats. You care about cancer research, but your spouse wants to see programs for the homeless. So all of this is the reason why donor intent sort of can go awry either nefariously or very, very easily. But I do want to mention why it matters. The U.S. has a rich history of empowering citizens to use our resources to participate in and contribute to the public square and civil society in general. It's woven into our history. It's backed by our courts. Stephen Carter, a professor at Yale, refers to philanthropy as democracy in action. It's why the U.S. is the most generous country on the planet. I could talk for 30 or 40 minutes on that topic alone, which I have done before. But another reason is when we thwart donor intent, we diminish sort of this pluralistic and competitive marketplace of ideas in which we find ourselves. We are limiting the possibilities of finding solutions to problems. We also disrespect the wealth creator, you know, perhaps the entrepreneur who created enormous value to society through a business venture, which alone is an important mechanism for social change. And now that he or she's sort of pursuing an avenue of interest in the philanthropic sector, and that is such an important independent source of power in this country. And so when we're denying somebody to have this freedom to pursue, we're somewhat unintentionally allowing the public sector to trespass in that domain. And then, as Stephanie mentioned in the beginning, conservative donors have suffered disproportionately with donor intent gone wrong. Some of you know John O'Sullivan with National Review, who has this lovely thing called O'Sullivan's Rule, which is essentially any organization that does not begin explicitly grounded in some sort of a free market principle will over time drift away from those principles. And what this means is that millions of dollars intended to support or promote private solutions are now sequestered for purposes that counter those principles. So when we violate donor intent, we also violate the most fundamental of ideas, which is it is not your money. Now, we want to believe that our children will honor our wishes the way that the Simon family has continued to do so, and I do hope they do. But if you treat your charitable causes sort of as your own children, it is necessary to take that extra step to make sure that they are part of your legacy plan. Bob mentioned some of the vehicles that are available that you can utilize. They're all valuable. They're all interchangeable, which is important. It's also important to note that we don't want to put the kids in a position to sort of fail or wrestle with some of these. And so when we utilize different tools, we actually sometimes separate that decision out for them entirely for the good of everyone. And as Bill said, the kids all seem to be closer because of it. So that's a nice side benefit. Now, just to reinforce some of the tools that were mentioned, you know, some of this is as simple as designated gifts to groups as just part of your will. Something to mention, though, it's important that you do this with percentages, not specific dollar amounts. Perhaps it's important you specify a specific period or a lump sum. This is, again, an area where donor advised funds can be a very useful tool. We can act as a hub for all these disparate pieces coming together. You can also make a donor advised fund provider your actual charitable target rather than individual entities, which means you only have to change your testamentary documents once, and then you provide as much information as you want to the donor advised fund provider when it comes to your interests, your favorite charities, when things change, and saves you a little bit of attorney's fees in the meantime. CRTs, CLTs, life insurance, as Bob mentioned, all of these are useful tools. If you want to know some more specifics, I suggest you sort of ask that in the Q&A. So when it kind of comes down to what are some very specific things you can do? Donors Trust provides something called 8 steps to securing your donor intent. If that's something that you would like, just ping us and we're happy to send that to you. I think it's also available on the website where you can just register and we'll get that to you. But some of it is fairly basic, you know, but we begin with being clear who you are, what you believe, why you believe it. What are some of the causes or societal changes or challenges that interest you? Be specific with your specific or favorite preferred charities. even those, the ones that you may be supporting later in your life, rank them according to your preferences, because resources may be more limited when the time comes to fund them. But also be specific about what you don't like, or groups that bother you, or perhaps ones that treated you poorly, or even CEOs that you find problematic and you would rather your dollars not follow that CEO where he or she may go. And then bind it in writing, write it down, record it, audio and video, record it again, revisit it once a year on your birthday or some other date, provide copies to multiple people, your spouse, your children, other family members, your attorney, sort of trusted third-party people. Identify the right vehicle, whatever it might be. And you might need multiple vehicles to really fully protect your intent. Timing. Decide what the timing will be. Is this something to be done in your lifetime or immediately upon your death? Is a private foundation what the plan's going to be when you're no longer with us? Do you want a specific payout requirement that maybe is above the mandated 5% minimum payout that foundations are required to do? Maybe you want to just bundle it in a donor advised fund, invest it so you have the opportunity to make a significant single payout to a particular cause. And be flexible. Life changes, vocations change, circumstances change. Maybe you'll develop a new passion for a new cause. Maybe there'll be a new group that suddenly interests you. Tax laws change, family wealth situation change. Visit that plan regularly so that you can make adjustments. And then lastly, as Bill mentioned, shut it down. If you really want the only way to secure your charitable intent and avoid drift, well, limit the lifetime of whatever vehicle you choose. Spending it down within one generation, roughly 20, 25 years, is a sure way to protect your intent. And frankly, you'll also be concentrating your gifts during that time to make a greater impact. And lastly, look, protecting donor intent is not just something to think about when you're dead. You need to defend it in life right now. We have situations where donor advised funds and community foundations are denying gifts to certain kinds of organizations. They are falling prey to this larger politicalization of philanthropy that we see going on. Things are getting weird with your alma mater. We're seeing a backlash to that. You know, groups change, individuals change. Not all nonprofits are created the same. And this can all happen very quickly. So for what it's worth, this is actually where Donors Trust can also be very helpful. So reach out to us to learn more about how we can do that, how we can be useful to you, whether you're an individual donor, a private foundation, a financial advisor, any other interested person who values the role that philanthropy plays, and more importantly, who cares what happens with your resources. So with that, let me bring back Stephanie, who's going to moderate some questions to any of us of any kind, and we'll go from there. So thank you.
Thank you, Lawson. And thank you, Bill and Bob. Those were all wonderful presentations. I've got some questions that have been put in Q&A. Bob, the first one is actually for you, that someone texted me here. How should we be preparing for the possible expiration of the lower estate tax in 2025?
That's a really good question and a tough question. It really depends on the size of your estate. If you're, you know, it's roughly 12 and a half million per person, it's 25 million total. If you're near that number, it's pretty hard to gift all of your money away to not, you know, in case it does happen, to utilize your gifting exemption. So I think the answer really depends on the size of your estate and how much you're willing to actually give up control of assets through gifting it to the lower generations.
Okay. Thank you. And Bill, it was really nice to see you talking. So with such a smile on your face when you talked about your dad and about your siblings, it's been really nice to see. We have a question in Q&A for you. Do you have a suggestion on when you should close a foundation and after how many years? I know Lawson said one generation, maybe 20, 25 years. Do you have any suggestions from what you've learned?
I would say that the foundations that I'm familiar with, you know, like our foundation, Olin, it was all, as Lawson said, within one generation of the donor's death. And so in our case, Dad died in 2000, as I mentioned, and we're closing down at the end of 23. And so it's about a generation.
Thank you. Thank you, Bill.
You know, Stephanie, I might add one thing. I think Bob touched on this too. You need to be comfortable that who is going to run it, you know, for the period of time you pick. So let's say it's one generation. You have to be comfortable that you have a group of people in place that you have confidence in. I've been helping a very dear friend with sunsetting his foundation, you know, after he passes. And that's a live question. So he may end up sunsetting it under, you know, 20 years, let's say, somewhere between 7 and 15 years. Because if at the end of the day, you don't want to have that management risk if you can avoid it.
Thank you, Bill. Lawson, the next one I just received is for you. Mm-hmm. Does Donors Trust ever work with family foundations?
Yes, the answer is most decidedly yes. We have many foundations that use us for various ways. I would say the most common reason, two most common reason. One is additional anonymity for grants, if that's important to the foundation. So on their 990, the only thing listed is going to be a contribution to Donors Trust as a nonprofit, but there'll be a division between what the grant request was and is. So as we like to say, I get yelled at, they don't. And then secondly, we oftentimes will work with the foundation where there may be a smaller discretionary pot that's given to, say, each trustee. And so each trustee may have an account with us. And sometimes there may be a unique gift being made with the approval of the trustees that may be slightly off mission. It's not a violation of intent, but it's a little different. So they'll use us for those kinds of activities. And then, as we've mentioned before, we have a young givers program called the Nova Society. And oftentimes some foundation folks will use that to help train, if you will, the next generation of givers, likely family members, children, grandchildren, to understand what it means and how to be philanthropically responsible. And obviously they have to fall within sort of the Donors Trust guardrails, but it gives them some discretion. So those are probably the three most common ways that we have. And then we have clients who actually will utilize both a donor advised fund and a private foundation when they are initially establishing a vehicle, because each has some tax benefits that when brought together can be useful.
And then I got a follow-up question there that for you. Why would someone use a donor advised fund over a family foundation?
Well, I think that, as I mentioned, the two reasons would be additional layer of privacy, if that's important. Secondly, a donor advised fund is less expensive to operate than a private foundation, all things being equal, and brought together, certain deductions apply differently. So you can get greater deductions with a donor advised fund than you can with a private foundation, or you can provide them together. The issue becomes also one of control. With a donor advised fund, legally speaking, you do not have control over your money. With a foundation, you do. And so those are some of the trade-offs and why oftentimes they're bundled together.
Thank you, Lawson. Bill, there's a question here saying, I'd love to hear from Bill how to resolve conflict with the leadership when it inevitably arises. How do you avoid damaging any working relationships?
Well, Stephanie, that's a great question. And so I'd say a couple of things. First, we have every year a certain amount of money allocated for directors to give to whatever they want to give to. You know, we don't scrutinize what they give to. And so hopefully that's a bit of a safety valve. And then we call those directors designated gifts. And then the second area, as I think I mentioned, you know, we had a great staff, Jim Pearson, Sarah Faye Snyder. And occasionally, if we thought that someone, you know, felt strongly about something that we didn't feel was in the bullseye, we would ask either Jim or Sarah to call. And that was usually a signal to them, let's not push it. And maybe there's another way to accomplish what you want to accomplish, but not with foundation corpus.
Thank you so much. I have another one here for Lawson. Is there a way to legally require that the successor who runs a DAF only give to the previous recipients of the DAF?
Make sure I understand the question. So my assumption is this is somebody who has a donor advised fund account. There's a successor advisor, and you're wanting that successor advisor to give to what you were doing originally. I'll answer that in two parts. Legally, difficult because of the structure of a donor advised fund being, obviously has complete control over that account. So at best, you can request it. This is where there are differences among donor advised fund providers. A donor's trust, for example, the successor advisor must abide by what the original advisor's intent is or was, unless that original advisor has given some discretion to the secondary advisor. So in our case, it's a promise because that's how we're going to operate. Legally is different. If you do not have a donor advised fund structure, instead you have a endowment where perhaps it's a specific gift agreement between an individual and a nonprofit, you may have an ability to more legally bind what that gift is, but it would no longer be a donor advised fund. So I think the quick answer is if it's a donor advised fund, legally very difficult, which is why it matters who your DAF provider is.
Thank you, Lawson. And one final question here. Bob, the last question is for you. You said that donor advised funds are one of your favorites. Why?
Well, for all the reasons that Lawson just talked about, they can give you the flexibility that you need. I like the idea, especially with donors trust, that the foundations that the donorized fund will shut down after a certain period of time. I'm very much concerned about this issue of Ford and all the other foundations that we talked about that are now, they all seem to evolve to the left. And I and my clients have all evolved to the right. So it gives us a protection that I'm very comfortable with. I don't want to make it any more political than that. So that's kind of why I like them.
Thank you, Bob. Thank you. And thank you, Bill. And thank you, Lawson and Lucas and Peter. And I'll leave it with Lawson for a final word here.
Sure. Well, thank you, Stephanie. And again, also thank you, Bill, and for Bob being generous with your time. We live in a world that is increasingly ruled by envy of power, of wealth, more specifically of other people's power and wealth and influence. And unfortunately, we're becoming increasingly disrespectful, and if that is to say, even intolerant of people's boundaries, of their beliefs, their principles, their philosophy, even their religious persuasion or not. You and I and all of us here should be able to participate in this sort of cacophony of civil discourse. You know, we should be able to use our resources, which also includes our time and our talents, as well as our money, to address what matters to us, whether that's $100 or $100 million. It is your lane. It is your money. It must be protected. And so with that, thank you again and have a wonderful afternoon.
Well, I hope you enjoyed hearing that as much as I enjoyed doing the interview and being a part of it. Donor intent is a really big deal. Even if it doesn't get talked about as much as it probably should, if you are at all charitable, you want to think through how to ensure your legacy gets carried out in the right way. We are releasing this episode with only a few weeks left in 2023. It is the time of year when a lot of people are thinking about their charitable giving and impact, the donations they want to make, even their legacy plan. We at Donors Trust would, of course, be happy to talk to you about how a donor advised fund could be beneficial to you and your planning here at the end of the year and well into the future, as it offers a nice way to simplify and protect and grow your giving in a tax-efficient way. And of course, that holds true if you aren't listening at the end of the year. We are always here and ready to chat and answer questions that either didn't get answered here on this webinar or to explore how these ideas apply to your own unique situation. Thank you for listening. Hope this was helpful, and I look forward to sharing another great conversation with you soon. Until then, thank you for being a giver. Let's talk more soon.